Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. She got booed at the Conservative Political Action Conference this year for calling out Republicans for hypocrisy on sexual harassment. But political analyst and author Mona Charon has been firing up the right and the left for a long time in print and on television. The target of her new book is feminism, what it got wrong, how it's damaged civil society, and how it's made women unhappy. This hour on Point, Mona Charon on why the differences between men and women really matter. You can join us on air or online. What does feminism mean to you? Do you embrace it? Run away from it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Mona Charon. Mona is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, as well as a syndicated columnist and contributor to National Review. Her latest book, which comes out today, is called Sex Matters: How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Mona, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Mona, I really enjoyed your book. Thank you for writing it. And I want you to give a little background for our listeners on how you came to write it, because I'm interested that you're writing about something that you lived. And I wonder whether the experience of becoming a mother affirmed your previous views or changed them.
Well, John, it kind of did both. First, let me just comment on something that you said in the introduction, because I want to be clear that I don't reject all aspects of feminism. I consider myself to be a feminist in some respects, and I honor the feminist movement for certain reforms that I think were very, very beneficial for society. Women being given every equal opportunity, rape victims being treated with respect by our legal system. There are many, many other things that I acknowledge are victories of feminism and deserve praise. Regarding my own evolution, though, it is interesting, I think, because I was a first grader when Betty Friedan published what is considered sort of the iconic first second wave feminist book, The Feminine Mystique. And so it influenced she and then her sisters in the movement that came along in the 70s and 80s, influenced my growing up and the environment in which I grew up. But I was able to see some of the changes that were happening in society, both through my own life and in the intellectual atmosphere. And I did always have a slightly skeptical eye because I never did buy the idea, first of all, that you could divide men and women into classes, namely that that men as a class oppressed women. I've seen many instances of women being the oppressors. I've seen many instances of women having all of the flaws and foibles that men have and vice versa. So I just don't accept the sort of men bad, women good template that modern feminism so often seemed wedded to.
Well, thank you. I don't embrace that template either. but let me go back to the origin that you described. So I'm a year older than you, I think. I was in second grade when Betty Friedan's book came out. Do you recall being conscious of that work, say, when you were in middle school or something like that? I remember hearing about it later, but not as a kid in suburban Washington, D.C., being much aware of that, although I think of my own mother who worked, took some time off for kids, but worked when we went back to school as somebody who was in the vanguard of the movement for women to pursue their aspirations in an equal way.
Right. I guess my memories of it are more, they really get going in high school and then in college with the Gloria Steinem, Germaine Greer, Kate Millett, and so forth. I went to a women's college in New York, Barnard College, where feminism was the order of the day. And if you were a feminist in good standing, it meant, in many instances, that it was a good thing to behave, as I put it in the book, as bad as the worst men. So that if a woman was sexually promiscuous, this was considered some kind of a victory for the sisterhood. And I was dubious about that at the time. I know lots of young women were dubious about it, but they were certainly influenced. And I think you can make a case that the backlash against this embrace of sort of the sexual revolution that the feminists were a part of had an immediate backlash among feminists themselves. So they're starting in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a splinter group of feminists who were anti-pornography. And in a way, you could say they were showing buyer's remorse about the whole sexual revolution aspect of feminism, if not about other aspects.
I want to go back to the import of the title of your book, because you properly point out that you do honor and embrace the aspects of feminism that you value the most, that is to say, people being equal to pursue what they want in life on equal footing with men. But it strikes me that the core of your book is saying that current feminists underestimate the actual differences between men and women, what they want, what motivates them. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I really do think, and the data I think supports the idea that many of the differences that we notice in society, that there are fewer women in Congress or fewer women CEOs and so forth than men, these things are often attributed to lingering discrimination, lack of opportunity, glass ceilings, leaky pipelines, you name it. We have a million buzzwords for why it is that women and men are not represented 50-50. Similarly, when it comes to the number of women who cut back at work to care for children, this is often portrayed, again, in the popular press and in the culture as a loss for women, that women are getting the short end of the stick. And I don't really believe that. Looking at the data, looking at the views of women, talking to women, my view is that women make choices and have certain preferences, and that the desire to actually spend time with their children is one of the very, very strong desires and wishes of many women, indeed most. I felt it myself. My husband and I just approached parenting in different ways. It turns out quite common ways for men and women. We're both incredibly dedicated to being parents, but it expressed itself differently. I had a real hands-on need to be there with the kids when they were very young. My husband felt a strong need to provide for us and to work harder and to be sort of the backup, which, by the way, is incredibly important to being a good parent, because there are, it really does take, ideally, it takes two people. None of us is a super person, and you get exhausted and you lose your temper, and you just need to be able to hand off a child sometimes and say, honey, it's your turn. But in any event, I, like many other women, chose to work part-time when my kids were young so that I could be there more. And this was important to me as a free choice. And it's really interesting when you look at women who have more choices, that is, women who are married and more, and by the way, being married frequently translates into being more affluent, those women choose to cut back at work much more than women who are poorer and not married. So when women have the opportunity, they avail themselves of it. And data also show, polls also show, that women who make these choices, I don't call it sacrifices because I think there are always trade-offs in life, and you gain as much as you so-called lose when you spend more time with your family. Women who make these choices are overwhelmingly happy with the choices that they have made. And so I think we have overplayed as a society the notion that it's somehow letting down the side for women to devote themselves to their own families.
Now, was there anything about the experience of being a mother that pulled you, for lack of a better term, to the left on any issues that we're talking about, feminist issues, that is to say, anything that made you think, oh, yeah, those arguments were right, as opposed to the reverse?
Well, I don't think on these issues. If you wanted a list of other issues in the age of Trump, I could easily
give will get to those.
A long list. But no, on the matters of family, I'm pretty pretty comfortable saying that that women are the more. I mean, now people are going to scream at me, and they're going to be upset when I say this, but I will stand by it. Women are by nature the more nurturant sex. And we know this from many, many pieces of data. We know it from what women say. We know it from what men say.
Is that really that controversial thing to say?
It is. Oh, believe me. You'll see in the comments when, as soon as this radio program is up. But people will be very resentful and they'll say that's old thinking. But if you look at, for example, women's entry into the workforce in large numbers, they didn't just enter every field at the same rate. They chose fields that they prefer. Guess what? Those happen to be the caring professions. So women tend to go into the practice of medicine and medical science more than into, say, you know, particle physics. They find working with people and animals, they dominate the veterinary medicine field, they find that rewarding. And I think that's a part of women's nature that should be celebrated, not denigrated.
Well, obviously, this is an extension of the nature-nurture debate that's gone on for a long time, and we're going to get into that more in the next segment. Hold right there, Mona Charon. We're discussing feminism, family life, and political civility. You can join the conversation. Are you a mother balancing work and child-rearing? Or a father, for that matter? Tell us about your experience. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. Today we're talking with Mona Charon, whose new book, Sex Matters, rips into some feminist assumptions and how she believes they've eroded family life, female happiness, and civil society. You can join the conversation. Anatomy aside, are men and women really all that different? Should we push back against those differences or embrace them? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now, once again, is syndicated columnist Mona Charon. Mona, I want to begin this segment by playing a piece of sound from the androgynous model Rain Dove, who was featured in Allure's video series Dispelling Beauty Myths last year. Here are her thoughts on gender.
I'm not transgender because gender doesn't exist in my book. I'm not transsexual because I love the body I have. My state of being is just unique. My name is Rain Dove, and the myth about gender that I'd like to dispel is that it's real.
So, Mona, it seems self-evident to me to say that gender is real, that it's not a social construct, but give me your thoughts on that.
Well, she certainly is on the cutting edge, and go to any campus and you will, or even most parts of Canada, apparently, and you'll be asked to state your gender preference and your preferred pronouns. This is, I think, and I argue in Sex Matters, that this is sort of a logical extension of an idea that really did get rolling with the original second wave feminists, who argued that there were really no differences between men and women that were not socially constructed. Science, though, caught up with them, and we discovered in the last 50 years that there are enormous numbers of differences between men and women, hormonal, developmental, even in brain organization and structure, that are significant enough that doctors have whole journals devoted to studying sex differences because it affects how the body responds to medicine. And anyway, these things are not just physiological, but they're psychological as well. And we know that they are innate and not socially constructed, although obviously some things are. We'd never deny that. But when you see traits, for example, that an infant girl, baby, will respond more readily to the sound of a human in distress than a boy baby, and that a boy baby will respond more to flashing lights and moving objects, you have to say, look, that cannot be socially constructed because it happens when the children are just days old. And when you see other patterns that are worldwide and that have been in every time and place that we know of, in every culture, again, you have to say, well, if they're universal, for example, men preferring looking for mates among women who are young and beautiful and women preferring mates who have resources, then maybe these things are hardwired. That's my point about bearing in mind that some of these things are real. But so back to the point about transgenderism and non-genderism and all of that. So the feminists kind of they did a little sleight of hand because science had caught up and shown that actually there are sexual differences between men and women. They actually invented this new term gender to refer to one's subjective feelings about sex rather than about one's sexuality rather than to objective facts about biology. And so it's a work in progress. I think everyone who has a, especially children who have sexual feelings that are at variance with their given sex deserve to be treated sensitively and certainly not humiliated or embarrassed. At the same time, I think the rush to say that every child who says that he at a very young age, 2, 3, 4 years old, that he wants to be called by the name of the other sex or dressed as the other sex, to encourage that as an authentic expression of transgenderism strikes me as really dangerous because children go through stages. I went through it myself. When I was a little girl, I asked people to call me Timmy and I played with trucks and I was a bit of a tomboy. And I really shudder to think what would happen if I had been come at a different time when it was parents were encouraged to see this as budding transgender feelings. It was just a stage.
The question, isn't it, that we're clearly hardwired in certain ways and influenced socially in other ways. Isn't the question of where is the line between constraint and the natural equilibrium of human beings? Where should you push back against that line as a way of providing people choices and options that they don't feel instinctively that they have or that society doesn't grant them?
Right. So I would argue that, of course, you know, there are certain givens and we push back against them. People have a tendency toward baseless hatred. People have a built-in tendency toward hating the outgroup. Basically, they have a built-in tendency toward aggression. All of those things every civilized society has to push back on. But when women have a desire to be caretakers, we should not push back against that out of some misguided sense that we have to have absolute 50-50 alignment of every single task in society. You
know, what about the issue of whether a young parent lets their daughter have a Barbie doll versus a football?
Oh, so, look, there are certain things that are just really hard to undo. And I have known many parents, I quote some of them in the book, who usually, you know, very well-meaning liberals. Two of my cousins that were in this category, too, gave their kids all sex-neutral toys, thought that they were not going to impose these ideas. And it's awfully tough. The boys wind up taking those blocks and making guns out of them or spears or whatever. And the girls wind up, as I say in the book, sitting under the slide at the in the playground and having long discussions about their feelings. That just happens. And I wouldn't worry too much about it. I also think that you have to be, if you're realistic about what the human material that you're given is, then you can mold it in a way without attempting to crush the spirit. So, for example, boys are rambunctious. They have, as I mentioned, a high level of aggression and sex drive. But so I'm the mother of three boys. I didn't think that they were going to behave like little girls. I knew that they had this innate tendency to be the way they are. But I tried to mold it in a positive direction. So when they wanted to run around and play war games or whatever, I would encourage them to see themselves as protecting the weak and standing up for what is right and just and fighting bad guys. And, you know, I put a moral gloss over what was a natural inclination. And I hope that that's a realistic way to look at it. I mean, to a degree, you obviously you can really overdo it with kids, and you can say that girls are only going to want to play with dolls and boys are only going to want to be aggressive. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of variety within the sexes.
Of course.
We've all known people, you know, who are girls who are very boyish and vice versa. And we have to be just relaxed about that. That's totally fine. But I think that there it's more often been the case recently that people have been, you know, fretting about, you know, not wanting to. There are even parents you read about today who don't want to give their children, don't want to acknowledge that their children are born a boy or a girl. They say, we're going to let them decide. I think that's kind of extreme.
But you've got three boys. I've got three girls. And let me tell you about a part of your book that I strongly identified with. And that is the part dealing with sex itself. And you talk about college campuses and the evolution of hookup culture and the notion that it's an advance of feminism to have women treat sex the same way that men do as a matter of equality. As I left college, because you and I went to college at the same time, and became a parent and would read the stories about this hookup culture, my strong feeling was that human beings are not wired that way. There is something unnatural about that kind of behavior. And it that is to say how men and women approach that behavior, the whole idea of sex without feeling and that sort of thing. Talk a little bit about that subject.
Yeah, I grieve actually for young people because of the sexual ecosystem that they've inherited. It's really, as you say, it's unnatural. It's a word I also use in the book. I certainly know that for many young women, and I talked to many of them when I was writing this book, it's extremely uncomfortable and not what they would be looking for to go out and get drunk and wind up in bed with somebody that they hardly know or do not know. They are eager for the things that women have always wanted. I mean, of course, bearing in mind, there are a few women who do fall into that category, but they're the exception. Most women want what they've always wanted, which is relationships. They want love. And they want to be courted and to be paid attention to as a whole human being.
And I'll just say, as a matter of equal time, there's some men who want that too.
And I was going to get to that. Men want it too. Men want love, but they're a little bit more reluctant to acknowledge it. It takes a little longer to get them to admit it because, of course, all this, you know, easy sex is something that's certainly more palatable to them, let's put it that way, than it is to women. But when you get into deep discussions with them, they will, many of them will say that they actually do wish that they, that it were easier to form relationships, and that they do, they are open to falling in love. They do want and need that. And let me talk a little bit more about the need part, because not only is this hookup culture really kind of the enemy of love, What we've developed in our society is a two-tiered culture. We have castes in America now where, for the most part, educated people are still getting married and behaving in their personal lives pretty much the way they did in the 1950s. They tend to finish their education, get a job, get married, and then have children in that order, and they are almost never poor. And you might say, oh, well, they're never poor because they have a college education. Well, that's part of it. But when you look at high school graduates who follow what is being called the success sequence, that is, again, finishing their education, even if it's just high school, getting a job, getting married, and only then having children, those people also have an incredibly low rate of poverty. And yet, for most working class people, marriage is no longer the norm. And they are in a position, both men and women are suffering badly because of this. Men, because they become disconnected from their children and from society. 22% of prime age males in America now, the record high in our history, other than the Great Depression, are not working, not connected to the workforce, and not looking for work. They are very frequently unmarried. When men marry, they tend to work harder, they tend to earn more, and they tend to be more involved in their communities. Women who have children without husbands tend to be struggling, exhausted. I mean, they love their kids and they try to do their best, and some do a great job, but they are one illness, one eviction, one job loss away from disaster all
the time.
So
many social issues flow from those two facts you just mentioned about married and unmarried men and women. Mona, let's go to the phones. We've got Chris on the line from Milwaukee. Chris, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I really appreciate this topic. And I wanted to say I grew up as a teenager in the 80s. And grew up in believing that I did not want to be a woman with an apron on. That was my whole plan. I did go to college and began working. I'm an older mom. I had my child at 42 with my husband. And I have to say, I've worked full-time up until then. And as a mom with two children, I don't believe it has to do with age. I feel I'm just as energetic as the next person. However, being home is a huge amount of work. It's harder than going to work, I believe. The issue is, I guess my question is, as stay-at-home, as a mother's at home, their esteem and their sense of being belonging in the world, I wonder if it's low, you know, in this age and culture. I think they're not given enough credit for the amount of work that really is involved. I don't think people really know.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. Mona, do you agree? Is there a self-esteem problem, and is there a societal appreciation problem?
There is definitely a societal appreciation problem. I cannot tell you how many times I've asked women what they do, and they've sort of looked a little bit embarrassed and said, well, I just stay home. I'm just a mother. And I've said, this is about the most important work there is. And they've said, well, you're the first person to ever say that. And, it's absolutely necessary to give that choice as much honor as any other, maybe more, because it's so critical for children and for the entire family. And by the way, when men do it, I honor it just as much. There are plenty of dads who choose the same route, and hooray for them. But it's usually the mothers, and it is incredibly difficult. It's it does make going to the office. Some women say they go to the office to escape the difficulty of parenting, but it's also incredibly joyful. And you know, I adored being with my kids, and it's an adventure, and it's, you know, it's trying and difficult, but boy, the rewards are just indescribable.
Where do you think the center of political gravity is on these questions we're talking about right now? Do you feel as if you're identified as a conservative commentator? Do you think that you are sort of shouting against the majority, or do you think the majority is with your way of looking at these issues?
Well, I can tell you this much. When you look at polling about who's happy with the choices that they've made, the women who cut back at work to take care of their kids are much happier than women who don't or than men who do. So that's revealing. When you look at the numbers of women who choose, as I say, women who have a choice, because if you're working class, you often have no choice, especially if you're not married. But for women who do have a choice, the numbers who choose to cut back while their kids are young and then return to work is very high. So that suggests that though many people may not be advertising this as a societal good, a lot of people are choosing it anyway.
Mona Charon, stay right there. We're discussing feminism, civility, and how sex matters in the age of Trump and Me Too. Join our conversation with Mona Charon. Is it appropriate for a restaurant to refuse service for political figures its employees disagree with? What role does Twitter and our other social media play in exacerbating civil discord? I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. Today we're talking with author Mona Charon about sex, feminism, Trump, and the breakdown of civility in society. You can join the conversation. Do you have children in high school or college? How do you talk to them about the Me Too movement and sexual assault? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is Mona Charon. She's a syndicated columnist and author of the new book, Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. Mona, I want you to listen to this clip from someone you write about in the book, Germaine Greer, one of the leading members of the second wave feminist movement, well known for her societal criticism and sharp tongue. In 2016, she participated in a debate about marriage at the University of Oxford. Here's what she said.
The thing that strikes me about marriage is that it doesn't do what it says on the tin. Everybody who has been talking tonight has been talking about love and fidelity and support and how everybody's got the right feelings and blah, blah, blah. 42% of our marriages will end in divorce.
Mona, a lot of them do end in divorce. What does that tell you?
Well, Germaine Greer is an interesting character. She's been on every side of a lot of major issues since she burst on the scene in 1970. But look, she was one of the group of feminists who were quite personally unhappy. She herself, I think, has been married three times. The prevalence of divorce is a complicated thing. So part of it is that we live in a society, and the United States leads the world in divorces, although the rate has come down since its high in 1980. And it may be in part our attitudes. Look, everybody agrees that their divorce has to be an escape hatch for terrible marriages. The problem comes when people are unrealistic about how much effort it takes to make any relationship work. And I cite data in the book about unhappy couples who were compared, those that chose to stay together despite severe problems, including fights over money, infidelity, and verbal abuse. And and couples that got divorced. And the ones who stayed together and worked on the relationship, they looked at them 5 years later, and they were happier with life and with their relationships than the ones who divorced. So part of this, I think we obviously we have to have divorce as an escape hatch in the worst situations, but it would be great if people were more focused on going into marriage with more realistic expectations, that it's not always going to be fantastic, that there are going to be times when you have to work on it and you have to work sometimes even separately. You know, there are some couples where they seek happiness in ways that are separate from one another, and that they're the independent types, and that can be successful. But the data are unequivocal that the happiest people are those who are married. They are happier and healthier and wealthier than those who are single or divorced. And as far as the effects on children, divorce is a really devastating disaster for many, many children. I would indeed say most children of divorce bear scars their entire lives, and we ought to be a lot more dubious about divorce as a royal road to happiness than we are.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jennifer on the line from Walpole, Massachusetts. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate this discussion. And my questions, comments dovetail actually the woman that was called in from Milwaukee. I am a 1960s baby. My husband and I went into our marriage consciously deciding that I would be the breadwinner based on education and opportunity. We have three children. And I'm curious just to hear your thoughts of the idea of women and breadwinners, because as I understand the data, if not 30% or more in households now, women in this country are driving the financial picture in their homes. I commend, like my husband, other men that have gone to the backseat of being the primary breadwinner and really being the boots on the ground to raising the family. I'm curious if you subscribe to that or not, because I kind of heard you make a comment earlier saying, hooray for that. But I got a sense as an undertone that you don't endorse that. And then secondly, I'd like to know what you think of that correlation of women as breadwinners and dad staying home to raise kids, and where you see that data point fitting into what I just read in the New York Times, as since the 1950s, men are kind of dropping off in the workforce in their middle age years, and also the Depression and so on and so forth. And lastly, in Massachusetts, interestingly, in my circle of friends, I find it interesting that most of my peers, women, middle-aged women, are the breadwinners, if not are solely breadwinners. And I'm just curious where that's all going to go and what you think. Has that made the whole feminist movement, has it put our society upside down?
Terrific points, Jennifer. Mona?
So I do say hooray. First of all, looked at from the perspective of children, which is the way I tend to view these things. I mean, it's very important for adult happiness to be married, but the most important thing is that children need two parents. And when the roles are the traditional role of breadwinner versus primary caretaker is flipped, and it's the man who does the majority of the childcare and the woman who does the breadwinning, great. As long as that child has a secure and happy home, that's wonderful. I do think it's been a little bit exaggerated how many homes this represents of married couples, because frequently when they refer to breadwinner moms, they're also including all of the single moms and all of the moms who are not actually working at all but are on public assistance. So I think it's closer, if I recall the data correctly, and forgive me if I don't have it exactly, but I think the data is something like 22% of married couples, the wife is the primary breadwinner. But that's quite a change from the 1950s, and that's one of the things that I would say is a great liberation and a nice alternative that the feminist movement made possible. But what worries me is that it is so much more common for women to attempt to handle all of the childcare without dads in the home at all.
Mona, I want to ask one last question, directly focus on your book before moving to other topics, and that is, in the book, you describe some claims of feminism that were at variance with how people were actually living their lives. And you talked, I think, about how there's a mythology about the 50s as a repressive time where did not celebrate women's achievement, and that then all that was turned upside down in the 60s and 70s, that women actually started entering the workforce decades earlier. If that's true, and if reality has a gravity to it that occurs irrespective of the elite conversation, and that if in the nature of human beings is that people pursue roles closer to your conception of what's natural, what does the elite conversation even matter? In other words, are people actually making choices in line with the view that you think is the dominant one? And if so, is this just about you arguing with other – I mean you as an elite yourself arguing with other elites as opposed to ordinary people who are making choices in their real lives that conform to what they want?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the elite conversation always matters. To give two quick examples. One is a caller that we had just a few minutes ago who said that she, you know, had chosen to stay home with her kids for a while, but that she didn't really feel respected for that choice. That's because the elite conversation is affecting her feelings. So that's one example. But another is that, you know, there's that saying, history is the polemic of the victor. Well, whoever writes the history has great power over how we see the world. And look at what happened, is happening now in Russia. They had a catastrophe under communism where at least 20 million people were murdered by the state. Midnight knocks at the door, gulags, horrible repression. And yet it has been expunged from the history books. The elites have decided that it never happened, and that it was a glorious time, and that they actually need to recreate the wonders of Stalinism in certain respects. Does that matter? It matters because the truth matters. And so it might make the Russian people a little less on guard against a return to that kind of horror in the future if they don't grapple with their own past. So I think you always have to know what the truth is and deal with it. Otherwise, people can repeat errors or be led into new ones.
Okay, let's bring this discussion into the contemporary frame that has been more dominant in recent political discussions. That is being living in America in the age of Trump, and in your case, being a conservative in the age of Trump. You were on an all-female panel at CPAC earlier this year and made national headlines for addressing your party's attitude toward women and sexual misconduct.
I'm disappointed in people on our side.
Okay.
For being hypocrites about sexual harassers and abusers of women who are in our party, who are sitting in the White House, who brag about their extramarital affairs, who brag about mistreating women. And because he happens to have an R after his name, we look the other way, we don't complain.
So talk about the reaction to your comments there.
Well, it was tremendous. And look, my feeling is that we are, you know, we are circling the drain in this country in terms of the poisonous partisanship that is all around us. And there is absolutely no way to get beyond it unless people are willing to criticize their own side. There's nothing easier than to point to the other side and say, but what about when Clinton did X or Y? I mean, and for liberals to say, it's all Republicans. Republicans have always been evil since the dawn of time, and Trump is just the apotheosis. That's, you know, that's not helpful. And it will only dig us further into a political grave. I think we all need to criticize our own side, to recognize the shortcomings of our own side, and to be willing to recognize our own blind spots and our own prejudices. And if we do that, you know, by the way, we may be wrong, right? All of us have to acknowledge we may be wrong. We may have missed something. And that's
right, you're
the only
pundit.
Way
you're not
back
supposed
to
say
society.
That, Mona.
I know. Sorry. I don't. I slipped.
Now, Mona, I want to get back to the substance of what you said at CPAC that got the criticism, and it relates to something else in your book. I'm holding two ideas at the same time. One, that the discussion of sexual assault on college campuses has gotten to frightening places in terms of the kinds of things that are being described as sexual assault and the ways in which they're adjudicated. And you talk about that in your book. On the other hand, I have learned a tremendous amount of things in the last few months about men's mistreatment of women that I did not realize before. How do you think about those two things at the same time?
Yeah. So when I started examining the whole rape crisis on campus, I was sympathetic to the conservative view that a lot of this was hysteria, it was regretted sex, it was women calling everything from a, you know, rub of the shoulder to, you know, to an unwanted kiss, sexual assault. And I acknowledge in the book there are cases like that. But when I began to talk with students and look at the data, I could not escape the obvious reality that there is a tremendous amount of extremely bad behavior and there is rape going on. Now, I don't think it's at the level that some of the activists say. I don't think it's one in five women. But I do think it is a really staggering amount of gross and bad behavior. And I don't think that it should be taken lightly. I don't think it should be passed over.
Let me give you one example that I believe did not exist, at least in my experience, did not exist when you and I were in college, that I've learned from my daughters in their college experiences. There are a significant number of guys who put stuff in the drinks of women in order to get them to have sex with them. Those
yes.
people should be in jail.
Date rape drugs, absolutely. But I'll tell you one quick story. It's in the book, but it's really important because I think it's so crucial to tell young women that they have to be careful. And this is anti-feminist. The feminists resent telling girls that they should watch themselves. For example, at one college, they developed a nail polish that would change color if a girl or a woman, a young woman, ingested a date rape drug in her drink. And some of the feminists protested this nail polish and said, I don't want to have to watch what I drink. I don't want to have to watch what I wear. I don't want to have to watch how I behave. That's just making me victimized again. That's not right. I don't want to live in such a world, which I think is crazy. The fact is, I don't want to live in a world where I have to memorize 50 passwords or not, you know, go into certain neighborhoods late at night or leave my house unlocked. But that's the world. And it is a kind of crazy rigidity to say you're not going to take any steps to protect yourself. Women have to be savvy about this new world where, and by the way, it's also the old world. I mean, there have always been bad people. But yeah, there's men slipping things into drinks. There are plenty of men who try to get women drunk so that they can, as the old-fashioned saying goes, take advantage of them. And they do. And women should be on their guard. And it shouldn't be anti-feminist to say that.
Let me ask you one final question, just a quick answer. When you talk about calling out your own side, would you agree that the polarization in the country is asymmetrical and that when you look at Donald Trump and Barack Obama, you see a greater problem in one party than the other?
Let me put it this way. Donald Trump is in a category all by himself in terms of the outrageousness of his behavior. But I had lots of criticism of Obama, and they're all available in my columns, which I wrote over the course of his 8-year presidency online.
That's a fantastic plug. Mona Charon, she's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a syndicated columnist, contributor to National Review. Her latest book out today is called Sex Matters. Mona, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it.
I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.